Our third panel is composed of the Honorable Shan Lewis, the President of the Intertribal Council of Arizona Incorporated from Phoenix, Arizona, Mr. Jewel James, the Policy Advisor, the Lummi Indian Nation, Bellingham, Washington, and Mr. Michael Nana Ping Garcia, President, the Indian Arts and Crafts Association from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Gentlemen, we welcome you to our Committee on Natural Resources today. We do have all of your prepared testimony, and it will be made part of the record if actually read. You may proceed as you desire and in the order in which I introduce you. Mr. President.
Chairman Rahal and Vice Chairman Hastings and other committee members, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Shan Lewis, and I'm the Vice Chairman of the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe and the current President of Intertribal Council of Arizona. The Intertribal Council of Arizona was established in 1952 to provide a unified voice for the member tribes in Arizona on common issues and concerns. Indian arts and crafts is one of those issues, not just for tribes in Arizona, but for all American Indian and Alaska Native communities throughout the country. Indian handmade arts and crafts have sustained the Indian people and Indian nations over our lifetimes. Indeed, the Indian Arts and Crafts Board was established in 1935 to promote the economic welfare of Indian tribes, the self-reliance of Indian individuals, which recognizing that our arts and crafts are unique and deeply tied to our cultural heritage. The 1990 passage of the Indian Arts and Crafts Act strengthened the intent of the 1935 establishment of the Indian Arts and Crafts Board by protecting the Indian artisan and the consumer from misrepresentations or fake Indian arts and crafts. The 1990 Act put teeth into the law by criminalizing the act of representing that as item is Indian made, which in fact is not. Sadly, in the 19 years that it has been in the law, the intent of the act has yet to be met. These crimes are rarely investigated, so the offenders go unprosecuted. Today, Indian arts and crafts continue to be a major source of tribal and individual Indian income. We witness this every year with events such as the Heard Museum Indian Market, which takes place every March in Phoenix, Arizona, and the Santa Fe Indian Market in New Mexico, which occurs every August. Hundreds of Indian artisans travel to sell crafts and arts that they make throughout the year. Thousands of art patrons and collectors attend these events because they trust that the items that they're purchasing are authentically made by Indians. If you visit any of these artists, they will tell you that the income they receive pays for their children's school supplies, for food they eat, and gas for transportation. For many Indian tribes, employment opportunities in Indian country are scarce. The Indian unemployment rate is among the highest of any cultural group nationally. Therefore, tribes member resorts to arts and crafts as a means of survival, which also keeps them close to home, their families, their culture, and religious obligations. Unfortunately, millions of dollars are diverted each year from these original artists and Indian tribes by individuals and companies that reproduce and sell counterfeit Indian goods in the United States and on the open market, internationally, and over the internet. Many of these items that are sold are Indian-made or as an Indian product are often mass-produced using cheap labor. Yet these individuals and companies are rarely, if ever, held accountable. Consequently, we do not know the extent of the problem and whoever is held accountable. H.R. 725 and S.151 amend the act which originally authorized the Federal Bureau of Investigations to address crimes prohibited by the act. At the time of its enactment, the investigatory responsibility seemed appropriate. It sent a signal that these crimes would be taken seriously such that they warranted the attention and resources of the FBI. In 1990, the FBI didn't have a full array of national security and anti-terrorism priorities that demand the majority of its resources today. Therefore, now more than ever, enforcing the criminal law that prohibits the sale of Indian arts and crafts misrepresented as an Indian product is often stalled by the other responsibilities of the FBI. Even at a time of passage, it is difficult for the FBI to focus on the referrals from the Arts and Crafts Board because their first priority in Indian country is responding to violent crimes such as homicide and child sex crimes. Now more than ever, I'm sure the FBI would agree that it would not open the investigation of an Indian Arts and Crafts Act violation unless it has some ties to its priority area of national security. Therefore, for the last 8 years, we can assume that little, if any, investigative activity has occurred to address these violations. Let me clarify and emphasize the important provision in the current amendment, strongly supported by the member tribes of the Intertribal Council of Arizona. The expansion of investigative authority would authorize other federal law enforcement officers, other than just the FBI, to conduct investigations of crime not just on tribal lands, but all lands within the jurisdiction of the United States. Without these additional federal officers given the authority to conduct these investigations, non-enforcement business as usual will continue with the same financial and cultural impact on tribal members, tribal communities, and tribal governments. Expanding the investigative authority to include other appropriate federal agencies is intended to promote the active investigation of alleged misconduct. The Indian Arts and Crafts Board has made meaningful efforts to educate the public and the business sector of the harmful effects of misrepresenting Indian arts and crafts. For example, it has used injunction provision to remove misleading information and advertisements from large and small businesses. It is also focused on implementing the trademark and patent provisions of the law and providing support of Indian tribal organizations and Indian artists. However, the board currently lacks a referral agency that will investigate bona fide criminal complaints. Passage of H.R. 725 and S.151 is long overdue. Versions of these two bills were originally introduced in 2005 and 2007. In fact, the same amendment was included in part of the Native American Omnibus Act S.536, which was passed out of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee in 2005. I encourage the committee to pass the bill out of the committee so that it may become law. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on this important matter.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you.
Jewel?
Thank you, Senator Ray Hall. Thanks for the opening statement. We really appreciate the kind words, and we appreciate the committee and the Lummi Nation that sent me here. Chairman Kagi is in Alaska participating in some Department of Justice consultation, and so I have the opportunity to be here and the honor to testify on behalf of the Lummi Nation, as well as the House of Tears Carvers. I'm the head carver of the House of Tears Carvers, and I originally developed it with three other Northwest artists that were totem pole carvers. They're all gone now. They have died from cancer, diabetes, and other diseases. One was a Vietnam vet, died from Agent Orange. But they all believed in the vision that we need to be able to market our native arts and share it with the public outside and use it as an opportunity to educate the general public as to our philosophy as Native Americans and how we relate to the surrounding environment. And in their memory, I continue to perpetuate the idea of the House of Tears Carvers. The Lummi Nation allowed us to incorporate, and by that incorporation under tribal law, it allows us to work with children. We've had children as young as 2 years old painting on our totem poles, and our philosophy is even if they make a mistake, we can sand the paint back off and put it on again. And we've had that happen where the child will paint it over and over and over again, but we've always encouraged them in a kind way and worked with them. All the way up to our elder carvers, the oldest carvers that we've worked with have been 84. And as you know, we went across the United States in order to participate in some of the healing of the nation by offering the healing poles. Behind the healing poles is the idea that Native Americans know grief. We've experienced a lot of historical trauma. A lot of historical trauma is tied to the direct attacks by law and policy of the United States upon the very culture that has sustained us through millenniums. We've seen our language destroyed, our housing structures destroyed, our form of traditional government, our traditional form of spirituality. We've seen our arts and crafts collected and burned or sent to museums or private collections. And for our elders that have passed on the stories, we have actually seen the scars where they have been whipped into compliance with the idea that they will forget their language and they will learn English and they will become good Christian farmers. And so within the tribal communities, there's a lot of historical trauma that has passed from generation to generation. But we know from studies that some of our peer tribes done amongst the Coast Salish that traditional culture and traditional arts and crafts is one vehicle for young Native Americans to actually decrease the attempts on suicide. Suicide amongst young Native American teenagers is the highest in the country. and exposure to culture seems to lessen their repeat attempts. The Lummi Nation has a Northwest Area, grant where we're encouraging some of the lowest 25% of the economic poverty-stricken population to actually use the Native American arts and crafts as a vehicle to earn income. And so we're developing a store that will market their art. We're hoping it'll provide some income for them. A lot of these artists will go from home to home, or they'll be down at places where cars come to a stop and try to sell it to a passing tourist or just a person happen to stop at the stop sign to make a few dollars so that they'll have something to eat with today. And so for those artists, it's a survival day to day. They never know if they're going to bring anything home for them. As our tribe continues to look at the value of art, we know that under our Lummi Systems of Care grant that we got from SAMHSA, that we're focusing on the introduction of Native art as a vehicle for mental health and teaching our communities and families how to overcome trauma. And the reason why we have a lot of faith in it is that there's something more than just a commercialization of Native art. Behind it is the sacred philosophy or the cosmology of our people. These are not signs, these are symbols. And whether it's a bear, a wolf, a raven, an eagle, an owl, a whale, a salmon, any of the animals or floral representations that are incorporated in the art, there's a teaching behind it that there's a way for us to live with the world around us. It's not just the human element, but it's also the environmental aspects of who we are and how we relate to the world around us. Our sacred cosmology is tied to the legends, myths, folklore, the song, dances, and ceremonies tied to the symbols incorporated in our art. And so when non-Native corporations or individuals reproduce our art and put it on the market as cheap replicas, they're also stealing the opportunity for us to pass on to the next generation these teachings. For the children that I have brought into my home, because I'm a home that brings in other orphan children because their parents are either drug addicted or alcoholic or have been abusive, I end up with a lot of Native children, and whether they have the opportunity to practice the art. And they learn the stories that go with it. They learn some ceremonies on how to care for the wood and how to prepare it for carving. They learn to listen, and they learn to incorporate some of the values and the ethics and the teachings that are important traditionally for them to learn. As a tribal member, I'm a member of the Lummi Traditional Spirit Society called Siawan. I'm also a member of the Sweat Lodge Societies, as well as a member of the Navajo Nation's Native American Church. I try to practice Native American spirituality and incorporate in the way we conduct ourselves as Native artists. As an organization, we will get a commission piece of art, and our children will learn to carve that pole, but at the same time, they're carving a charity pole to be raised in public. We not only raise poles in New York, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., but we raise poles for the Old Soldiers Home in Washington State, a charity donation. We put poles up along rivers to remember children who died in a gasoline explosion, pipeline explosion, as well as to remember that that river had to be restored. We raise poles along the Stillaguamish River and the Nooksack River to remember that we have a duty and obligation to protect the rivers and the salmon habitat to restore those populations to healthy levels, because we live off the salmon populations. And so we're very concerned about how the art is being used and how it's being marketed. I know I bid on an opportunity in a casino operation, and they really said that we're going to have the contract, and next thing I know, Chainsaw Jack from Concrete got it. He's a non-Native, and they don't say it's by Chainsaw Jack, but it's by Chainsaw Jack, and of course we're dismayed, you know. But we see this happening now where even there's plastic replicas being raised called totem poles inside our own Native American communities. We also see where non-Natives enter sham agreements. That is, they have mastered the art. They're not Native. They're not enrolled. And by law, they don't have the right to practice the art and market the art. But what they do is they put up one or two young Native Americans up front and get the contract, and then they walk away the majority of the proceeds. And so it's a sham agreement. Now, that's acceptable if that person has mastered the art for them to train the Native artists, especially in communities where the art has been lost due to past historical trauma. But if they do it as a teacher, that's one thing. And as a teacher, they should be entitled to a de minimis amount of the proceeds from the contract, but not the majority. And so we have concerns there. We also would like to highly recommend that sometimes that we include some of the teachings and the knowledge of Gregory Kahiti in regards to University of New Mexico and his publication on Native Science, because he was able to analyze how our song, dance, stories, and our mythology reinforces the value of our traditional arts for teaching how to live with the environment around us. I know in our testimony on the second page, we're asking for some clarification as to whether or not our arts and crafts in the Pacific Northwest could be defined as a contribution to our local fisheries management as our aspect of native management, native science. The reason is that we're not only having to protect ourselves against non-Indian individual profiteers, such as the imports coming from Asia that are being marketed in SeaTac and other tourist stores, but also we have problems with Department of Treasury, Internal Revenue Service, trying to go out and collect taxes and from Native artists. We know that that's going to have to go in front of the House Ways and Means, but we hope to generate support on the Natural Resources Committee to get clarification in the future. We fully support the idea of this language going all the way through as quick as possible. We know Indian country has been waiting a long time to be able to file claim against those that are violating our rights as indigenous people. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Mr. Garcia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
President Garcia, sorry.
Excuse me?
President Garcia.
Mr. Garcia is fine, too. I'll answer to either one. But thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for allowing me this opportunity to speak before you. As it states, I'm president of the Indian Arts and Crafts Association in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For 35 years, we've been promoting, preserving, and protecting authentic handmade Native American arts and crafts, and it has been an extremely uphill battle, believe me. I'm also a third-generation Native American jeweler. I have a business degree from the University of New Mexico. I never have had any metal smithing or lapidary education, formal education, but yet I travel worldwide. The laws that are on the books, I mean, it's long past due. I felt the sting myself and my own family. It devastated us back in the 70s when they flooded our market with fakes and frauds and counterfeits. They literally destroyed it. It's still going on very, very much in Santa Fe. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Mr. Jewell said, something needs to be done. It needs to be done. We need some dignity. Like he mentioned, our lands, our language have been taken from us. All we're asking for is some dignity for our arts. What is ours? What is truly ours? Turquoise, I'm sure, his totems. I mean, there's over 500 nations in this great country of ours that have, each one has a unique art form. Some of our founding members of the Indian Arts and Crafts Association were Ben Nighthorse Campbell, Mark Bhatti. Some of these people go back generations who want to keep it true to the industry. We have over 500 members worldwide that deal in only authentic, handmade Indian arts and crafts from Europe to Australia. We have two wholesale shows a year in Albuquerque and Phoenix to bring people within our industry together to buy authentic, handmade arts and crafts. As the other gentleman stated, also the Santa Fe Indian Market, there's outlets like the Heard Museum where you can go and you can buy authentic Native arts and crafts. You have to be careful because we're such a small community of Native artists. Like I said, there's a circuit out there. You can, at any time of the month, you can be at a Native American art show. But there's a limited amount of people who really deal in Native arts. And you have to be scared, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, whose toes you step on when the laws are coming into play. Because there's certain people out there that'll go as far as violence. I've been threatened before about my work and who's selling it and who's handling it. I found knockoffs of my work in Japan. So what I'm trying to say, it can get scary out there for me as an artist and stuff, and dealing with certain individuals that are in the trade who deal in stones, who deal, have multiple stores and stuff. There's a certain group of people that have been notorious over the years in really devastating our Native arts. Jewelry has always been a main culprit of counterfeiting. The last year, I went over to six different countries. I see it in baskets now. I see it in pottery. I see it in weaving. And now with the internet, it has become, I mean, even worse. It's terrible. I've also went as far as to file a formal complaint at the IACB about a bracelet that I made several years ago. Someone scratched off my hallmark, Nanaping, and put on Charles Lola Mahallmark, who was a very famous jeweler. and stuff. And what I, as far as the IACB, I think there needs to be not as much red tape. Make it easier to prosecute people that do things like this. It angered me when they did this. Something that I took from my heart and soul and created from deep inside me, and they took off my hallmark and put on a very famous jeweler that, in another way, honored me because he's such a well-known jeweler. But still, it angered me that they're able to do this and get away with this day after day after day, and nothing's being, not enough is being done. Like I said, something needs to be done. IACA has been there. We do a lot of outreach education programs. We do a lot of literature on all the arts, blankets, pottery, weavings, stuff. We work with the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, SWAYA, of course, the Poe Center. So we're trying to bring a lot of our organizations to. So I think education is the key to educate not just the buyer, but the world, who we are as a people.